Well, we're still here, so let's talk about it. Today, I thought we would revisit this ethical thanatology piece that I had brought to you a couple weeks ago. I explained at that time that I was getting way off topic, if you will, still exploring ethics, but in ways that I feel like I dishonored some of the topics that I would want to cover more in depth. So today, what I'm really going to do is basically read the script. I think what I had written in my notes was great, still longer than what I wanted in a brief overview of ethical thanatology, but for our purposes today, to stay true to the facts that I gathered, I want to be able to read it to you so that I don't interject any off-the-cuff thoughts. I think that really helps bring to you what I had put together. The best thing I can do is say, let's get started. Ethics. The definition is moral principles that govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. As we have been exploring thanatology, we discovered that there are subcategories within that broad field of study. Those who study this field or who are medical professionals are held to the four pillars of medical ethics in the practice of their profession. For medical professionals, the four pillars are beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy, and justice. Let's break these down. Beneficence, or doing good. This is described as physicians should make decisions based on what will be beneficial to a patient. Their commitment to helping others is the goal, and as such, there must be a net benefit over harm. Decisions on diagnostic pathways, treatment plans, and societal policies all must balance the benefit versus harms. And these balances also must be made in context of the patient's values. That came out of Gillen in a journal of 1994. What I get from this quote is that the harm of any diagnostic studies or treatment plans must be balanced with the benefits of such testing and treatment. Let's take an example. Blood work. This requires a needle stick to obtain a sample or an x-ray of a body part that really hurts, but it has to be placed just so in order to get the image the doctor needs, and these can cause discomfort and or pain. What one person considers a minor inconvenience could be quite traumatic for another person. Additionally, treatment plans may involve many needle sticks, stitches, or side effects which cause pain, discomfort like nausea, or the limitation of movement in order to repair an injury or cure a disease. What a patient believes is important to their quality of life should also be considered, along with their ability to pay for testing and treatments. Their religion may also limit medical interventions, or perhaps cultural practices that would ban certain therapies or procedures could affect patient decision making. And a healthcare provider must be able to weigh and consider all aspects of a treatment plan. The next pillar is non-maleficence, or not doing unnecessary harm. As stated before, some procedures cause pain or some harm. Consider getting stitches or having surgery. There is pain associated with these procedures, and the skin and tissues are quote-unquote harmed, in that they have been cut and then are stitched back together. Sometimes the muscles and or tissues are cut, which take time to heal, and that can be painful. Compared to the reason for having the stitches or surgery, however, the treatment should improve the patient's condition. For example, no infection or no need for more drastic measures. In this case, having the surgery or stitches outweighs the harm of having these procedures performed because once healed, the patient's quality of life improves. Most importantly, harm should not be the intent behind the procedure. Number three is autonomy, the right or condition of self-government. An adult person should have the ability to consider and decide on medical interventions they will undergo, and in the case of a minor child, the parent or responsible authority for the child should be able to make decisions and act on the child's behalf. Autonomy allows a patient to choose freely where he or she is able. A patient can decide on the end-of-life care they wish to receive, and it allows for the patient to reduce treatment as well. This can be done through verbal consent or removal of consent if a treatment had already been given in the past. This autonomy allows for a patient to designate an agent, such as a family member or other designee, to act on the patient's behalf if the patient is unable to make decisions or is unable to communicate. The fourth pillar is justice. All patients deserve fair and appropriate treatment. Justice ensures fair distribution of healthcare resources. In other words, providers must be honest with their patient regarding diagnosis, prognosis, or forecast of the disease process and the possible consequences of their condition, such as doing nothing. This allows the patient to have knowledge and understanding of their situation in order to aid in decision-making. Interestingly, a patient also has the right not to know. An ethical dilemma arises in this case, since physicians are expected to provide as much information honestly and accurately as a patient wants to know about their condition, and to provide information on available treatments and their associated risks, benefits, and alternatives. Additionally, when a patient desires a treatment that is not considered beneficial, such as something that could cause damage or prolong life without benefit, or if a patient requests unnecessary procedures requiring excessive resources or futile treatments, a physician must consider the ethical value along with the patient's right to choose. In most countries, the legal opinion is that patients cannot seek treatment that is not in their best interest and that physicians should not strive to protect life at all costs. Legal and ethical issues in end-of-life care include a patient's decision-making capacity, the right to refuse treatment, withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment, make no-code or do-not-resuscitate decisions, and whether to choose assisted suicide. So, since we discuss end-of-life, what can a patient choose at the end of their life? A patient can choose to have CPR, otherwise known as cardiopulmonary resuscitation, mechanical ventilation, artificial nutrition, and hydration, but a patient may also make decisions on supportive treatments, such as something called extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is shortened to ECMO, medical circulatory support, terminal sedation, stopping a treatment already begun, withholding a treatment, and euthanasia. Physicians and medical professionals should be able to define an ethical approach to making decisions about withholding and withdrawing treatment and must be aware of their patient's capacity to make these decisions, the patient's beliefs, their clinical condition, and the patient's preferences. This, of course, can only be accomplished through discussion with the patient or the patient's healthcare agent if the patient is incapable. The doctor and patient or patient's designee must agree that there is no benefit in continuing an intervention before it is withdrawn. The physician must also consider the applicable laws and evidence as well as the available resources. As I mentioned earlier, the patient also has the right to refuse treatment. All of this is expected to be accomplished while maintaining respect of the patient and or the patient designee as well as the family. In the case of advance directive, power of attorney for healthcare or healthcare proxy, the same respect and autonomy should be afforded the legal documents. This quote sums it up. If thanatologists' ethical responsibilities conflict with law, regulations, practice standards, or other governing legal authority, thanatologists make known their commitment to this code of ethics and take steps to resolve the conflict in a responsible manner. I'd like to mention some ethical considerations physicians face in patient care as it relates to end of life. Of course, the four pillars should be applied with the goal of improving or sustaining quality of life, helping a patient cope with their illness or diagnosis, and upholding patient dignity while caring for a patient. A physician can initiate a discussion of end-of-life choices, and the patient and their family can also begin the discussion of advanced care planning so all involved can make the best decisions with full knowledge and understanding of the available interventions. Parents of a minor child are the proxy for the child, and disagreement with the physician's plan may arise. Effective communication is essential through verbal and nonverbal means. A physician can talk with parents, offer literature to read from, or provide for the parent to read themselves. And a physician should make space for questions so the parent can better assess the care needs for their child. Ethics committees exist to help resolve conflicts that arise when a patient or parent does not agree with the recommendations for treatment and insist on a treatment that has been considered by the physician to be non-beneficial. In the case of the child, sometimes the parents simply need time to consider the information and the needs of their child, ask more questions, or get a second opinion before they can agree. On occasion, the courts get involved if agreement cannot be achieved. Here is another quote. Physicians sometimes think that the decisions made by family members are not the most appropriate decisions for the patients. In cases of conflict between intensive care teams and family members, assistance from institutional ethics committees may be sought. Moving on, emergency departments don't often have knowledge of advance directive or a family proxy is unavailable when a patient is brought into the department. They have the ethical duty to administer all means to support life without the knowledge of the patient's wishes or the presence of family. For example, they must decide whether to start or continue CPR on behalf of the patient or continue life-saving measures. In the case of euthanasia, a very controversial end-of-life decision, a physician must consider patient autonomy and the patient's right to decide. This has legal and political implications. While advance directives and healthcare proxies have become important tools for patients to have their end-of-life decisions known as they relate to life-saving treatments, the laws in each state govern their jurisdiction and the physician in the jurisdiction. At present, only a handful of states in the United States have enacted laws allowing physician-assisted suicide and/or the withholding or withdrawal of nutrition and hydration. The dilemma is that some see these actions as murder. Some politicians have expressed concern that voluntary euthanasia could become a treatment option in and of itself without employing life-prolonging treatments that could be beneficial. I do plan to talk more about euthanasia as some methods are kind of becoming eminent in the end-of-life space, and I definitely want to describe those more in depth. Because I really feel that's where, you know, we want to focus our end-of-life talks. To kind of summarize, in looking into the ethics of thanatology, I learned mostly about the medical ethics involved in end-of-life decision-making, but there are legal and political impacts as well. Dying and death are personal to the individual facing end-of-life. Laws are made to support the patient, and I think it's important to keep that in mind. Let's face it, some political candidates also use this as a platform for campaigning. That aside, dying and death, again, are personal to the individual facing the end of life. As such, we cannot ignore that in addition to all the medical education and training, physicians and medical professionals must also follow ethical standards and guidelines. Thankfully, they have peers and committees to assist them. Also, more and more educational institutions are recognizing the importance of patient education and are including this in their degree programs. Patients have the right to be included in their healthcare decisions, and physicians must honor that while treating the patient with dignity and respect, while at the same time educating them on their choices. Keep in mind that respect for the autonomy of a patient seeking to continue or initiate treatment should be questioned when it would lead to enormous harm, the unnecessary or unequal distribution of resources, or action requiring the physician to act illegally. I was also stirred by the notion that a patient has the right not to know about their prognosis. Consider this. For a physician to be called to honesty and accurate description of a patient's condition, how can a physician hold back from sharing information the patient does not want to know and still provide the beneficial treatments a patient needs to restore or maintain quality of life? How can we, as people who will die, make sure our families know whether we choose CPR, feeding tubes, blood transfusions, or ECMO? These are discussions we can have today. If you don't know what you would choose, take a look around you. Your friends, your family members, sometimes co-workers or gym mates can start this discussion quite casually. This may be just the inspiration you need to make a further plan to seriously discuss your end-of-life wishes. Lastly, I would want to say, make sure that your doctor is aware of these decisions. The family needs to know. Your caregiver or healthcare provider also needs to know. Thanks for listening today. Much more on ethics to come, but in smaller chunks. I'm thankful you listened today. Please visit my website and drop me a question or a topic for future discussion. Also, in the show notes, you'll find any reference materials such as names or book titles that I discussed in this podcast. Until next time, folks, take care.